This is Top Landing Gear. Hello and welcome to Top Landing Gear Full Flaps and to our full-length interview with Mike Woodley, owner of Aviation Filming Limited, based at Dunsfold Airfield in Surrey. The company specialises in aviation content for film and TV, including a huge number of the Bond films. Among Aviation Filming's fleet are three former BA Boeing 747s, which are regularly used as film props, and a very famous Douglas Dakota. Well, we met up with Mike in his office beneath the control tower at Dunsfold in May 2023 to hear some of his incredible stories about the film and aviation industry. Enjoy. Well, we're with Mike Woodley at Dunsfold. This is a trip the four of us have been wanting to make for years because we all live quite close to Dunsfold. We've covered these jumbos coming in, and this is the man who owns the jumbos, Mike Woodley, from what is now Aviation Filming, formerly Aces High. Mike, thank you so much for allowing us to come here today. And I gather the filming process is absolutely booming.
Yeah, it is at the moment because the government have actually changed the tax rules on filming, and you get about 30-35% back on the investment if you do it in the UK. So everyone's coming out of Bollywood and Hollywood, and they're all making the films in the UK, where we have the best technicians, but a shortage of studio space, so they're building more studios as we speak. Yeah.
So we've come here today. There's a mass of people who are wrecking one of the 747s here, one of the BA 747s for a production. You've got seven productions here this week.
Yeah, some of them are like the one in the control tower. It's just a BBC and it's for a day. So, you know, and others, one we did recently was 3 months, which was about the hijacking of the Kuwaiti 747 in 1988.
Cool.
Called Flight 422.
That's coming out soon, is it?
It's all in Arabic.
Okay. Not sure if we're going to see that one. But Mike, just let's go back to the beginning of all this and your involvement. How your background in aviation first might be a place to start.
Yeah, well, people say to me, you know, how did you get started? And it's really a hobby that got out of control, really. I was interested in airplanes. Well, in fact, I was an aircraft spotter. And I used to go to Croydon Airport in the late 50s and collect the numbers, and now I collect the planes. I can't remember the numbers.
but you were a pilot. Still are a pilot, I think I'm right saying.
No, I've hung up the goggles now. I've actually quit flying. I flew for about 50 years. Yeah.
What were you doing?
All sorts of things. I was flying helicopters and planes and flew for the airlines, which was the worst job I ever had.
Why? Oh, James.
Well, because it's very boring and it's a dead man's shoes job. You know, it doesn't matter how good you are, you can't get promoted because you're a good pilot. You can only get promoted because someone leaves or dies, you know.
Don't start me off on that, honestly. I've got hours of talking about that.
James is still a first officer. He's nearing retirement.
Well, every time I got promoted to captain, the airline went broke. So
I've got hours of this stuff we can go on about if you like.
Yeah.
I don't think
it's really my fault, but they don't take direct entry captains, so you start again. You start all over again, so I'm not fed up with that.
Yeah. But what were you flying?
Mainly DC-3s. I started on DC-3s and I ended up on DC-3s. I still got the DC-3. Yeah.
Who are you flying DC-3s for in the first place?
Intra and Air BVI and various people. And then the one we bought, we did all the air shows and filming and stuff with.
Yeah. Oh, how fantastic. Yes, the one that you own, the Dakota that's here, was in that program, that series, Airline.
I love that. Roy Marsden.
That's right. Yeah. It was Vera Lynn was the name of that particular...
That was our big break, actually. Yeah, that was a company called YTV, which no longer exists.
Yorkshire.
Which is part of Trident Television. And they were based in Leeds, and we bought about four or five from the Spanish Air Force for the film. You know. One of them we wrote off on top of a house.
On purpose?
Yeah, it was part of the film. The thing takes off with the... overloaded with the pins and the undercarriage.
Can't
get the undercarriage up and he hits a house. That was Anthony Valentine who was flying that one. Yeah.
I do remember that. Mm. I've got the whole series on DVD.
I still find myself humming the theme tune from time to time.
Great theme tune.
Yeah, great theme tune.
Where was that done?
We did quite a lot in Malta. We did all the Berlin Airlift scenes in Malta.
Oh, did you?
And we did a lot of it at Duxford and Church Fenton and Leeds Bradford.
All right.
We're, you know, moved around quite a bit. Ruffington, I think, name of the other place, XRAF.
Yeah. And that Dakota actually has quite an interesting history, doesn't it?
That one is the lowest time one in the world. It's done 3,600 hours total time, and most of them have done over 100,000, to give you an idea. And it was on the Berlin airlift, and it was on D-Day. It was a glider snatcher.
What is a glider snatcher?
Well, it's quite a rare thing. It only had six. And what they would do, the gliders all went over, and a lot of them got written off and crashed into trees and into each other. But some of them landed successfully.
Yeah.
And they wanted to get them back to the UK so that they could bring them back out with more troops on board. So what they did, they set up a goalpost with a kind of rubber bungee thing and fitted a tail hook to the DC-3, lined the thing up into wind with the two pilots in the glider sitting on the ground. Then the DC-3 would fly over the top and hook this thing and drag the glider off.
No way.
I never, ever knew that. I didn't know they recovered the gliders.
Yeah, it was a...
And God, the health and safety executive didn't get involved.
I don't think I'd want to be in the glider.
No, really. I'm not sure I'd want to be in the Dakota, but there is still a system, isn't there, used for rescuing... it's an American system for rescuing airmen or soldiers from the middle of the battlefield where they have a line dropped from an aircraft.
There's a balloon,
that's right.
The aircraft's got a big sort of Y or B on the front of it, and it snatches the wire from the balloon and takes them away. I think it's used in extreme circumstances only.
Yeah, I've seen it done at Fairford. Actually, they did it one year with the Hercules. Absolutely extraordinary.
They did it on one of the Bond films, the one that I think was Dr. No, actually, at the end where he's in the dinghy with the girl.
Yes.
And he lets the balloon go up and a B-17 comes over with a snatcher on the front.
That's exactly it.
And jerks them out. There's a hell of a G-force, apparently, when you get jerked out of this.
I bet there is. What happens to you then once you're up in the air?
Well, it's
a bit
rough on the landing, I believe.
I find a really big mattress somewhere and just drop it.
Grass burns.
God. Wow. So airline was your big break with the Dakota. And how did things sort of balloon from there? This is when you were... Had Aces High been formed by then?
Yeah, Aces High at Duxford. And we started at Duxford, and we were at Duxford for a few years. And we actually owned, during our existence, we owned 18 DC-3s that
we bought
for films and sold after the films and so on. Yeah.
Is the DC-3 easy to keep going? Or is it?
Yeah, the reason it keeps going is because the replacement aircraft, like the Vickers Viking and things like that, and the Dart Herald and the F-27, all had spars, main spars, to keep the wings on. And the spars have a life called a spar life. And they all exist for 60,000 hours or whatever it is, and then it's not really worth changing the spar on most of them, so they get scrapped at that point. Whereas the DC-3 doesn't have a spar. The wings are bolted on. There's 2,000 bolts, nuts and bolts. So it goes on forever. So you just change the nuts and bolts. Yeah,
that is fascinating.
Wow. They're a bit like Land Rovers, aren't they? I think the DC-3s are still... I won't say there's 80% of... I think 80% of all Land Rovers ever built are still operable.
Are they?
And on the road. Maybe not quite the same for the DC-3, but there's an enormous number of them, I think, still flying in the world around the world.
Well, they built, I think, 18,000, if my memory serves me correct. Now, that was more than all the other airliners in the world put together. Mm. And you think, well, what does that mean? Well, the most successful British airliner ever built was, I think, all the Vickers Viscount.
Yeah.
And I think they built something like 500. They built 18,000 DC-3s.
That tells a story.
And the BC-10, they built 65 or something. You know, it was
less than that.
And the most successful American airplane, other than the DC-3, was the Boeing 727. They built 2,000, I think.
Wow.
So it gives you an idea. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you took all the airliners, all the seven, all the Comets, all the everything, put them all together, you still have more DC-3s.
Incredible, isn't it?
And now. The best replacement for a DC-3.
It's another DC-3.
And they make them. And they cost $8 million each.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Are they all turbo engines now?
Yeah, they stretch the fuselage. Take a DC-3, stretch the fuselage, and put turboprops in. And it's fabulous airplane.
It's not the right sound, though, is it, for a DC-3? That's not the right sound at all. Are they, Wright Cyclones, these, on the DC-3?
Pratt & Whitney. Yeah. The original one had Wright Cyclones.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, people don't realise that they came out in, I think it was about 1934.
Yeah.
DC-1.
This one was 1942, I think, wasn't it, yours?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Still incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. Was it used on the, the big flyover to commemorate, was it D-Day a few years ago?
Yes.
There was a mass flyover of Dakotas from here.
Yeah, we were
to,
on that, yeah.
Was yours on that? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was on most of the things. We led the 40th and 50th anniversary of the Normandy D-Day and had C-130s following us. And the idea was to drop the parachute, so the DC-3 would drop its parachutes, yeah, and the C-130s would drop at the same time. So you had a DC-3 flying over and then 300 or 400 parachutes coming out,
yeah,
with the C-130s. But the thing is, with when you're dropping the parachute, is you've got to slow right down and put some flap down, and because you've got the door off and what have you. So yeah, the old C-130s were
going to overtake you. So you have to be licensed to be able to drop paratroopers, which your Dakota clearly is.
It has a special static line, which is checked every so often by the CAA and goes away for testing.
Yeah, how fantastic.
But it's all original inside. The aeroplane is totally World War II. Nothing's been changed. And, you know, it's got all the stretcher things in it, and it's got the old Morse code key, and it's got all the World War II radio operator's position. When they flew it with a crew of five. They had a pilot, a co-pilot, a flight engineer, a navigator, and a radio operator.
Right. Gosh. Yeah, I have clambered around your DC-3, actually, in the days of Wings and Wheels, and it really, you just go straight back in time. I think there are still some bullet holes in it left
over.
Yeah,
they've been patched up.
Have they?
How often do you fly her, Mike? Because I'm certain I saw it maybe a week or two ago.
Sure, it wasn't a Hercules.
I did make that mistake once.
It's actually been on the ground for a couple of years since COVID, so we put it in on the hangar that we built at North Weald, and it lives in there. Because the insurance has gone out through the roof on this is why there's hardly anything at air shows. You know, they say the Great Northwest Air Show is going to be held on June the 1st or something, and it has two tiger moths in it this year, you know. Yeah. No one can afford the insurance.
Is that since Shoreham?
Chappie, who thought he was in the Jet Provost when he was in Hunter or something.
Yeah, still being investigated, then, I think.
Have you interviewed him?
No. I know Rod Dean quite well, though, who was the air show director at Shoreham.
Yeah.
No, we haven't spoken to
Andy Hill.
Well done. No, I doubt we will. I doubt he'd want to hear from us, and it's probably still sub judice anyway. But I mean, the show that used to happen here, did you have a hand in that? Because it was such a brilliant show, Wings and Wheels at Dunsfold.
Yeah,
sad it's gone.
What happened was we were at North Weald, and the developers came along and said, we want to smash this place to pieces and build a big housing development, you know. And of course, the council owned it, and we had a 50-year lease. So I thought, better find somewhere else to go, you know, because you can't fight housing development. Yeah. So we heard this place was up for sale, and we made a bid for it, but we were outbid by developers who bought it. And then I said, why don't we just keep it going as an airfield in the meantime and have an air show and do things and bring in some money, you know, until you get the okay for the houses. So I said, all right, yeah. That was 15 years ago. There's no houses here yet.
No. Do you know what's happening there?
Well, it's beyond my pay grade.
Yeah. Yeah.
No idea. I think you might have told me this, Mike, actually, but we did hear when we came to see you and your second jumbo came in, that there was talk of this place going for a film lot. And we still rather hope that might be the case, but
It's one of those things, you know, where if you've got something like an airfield and it has a value, you can add a naught to that if you put houses on it. Because you're talking about £1 million an acre, and this site is 600 acres, to give you an idea.
Gosh.
And they forced me out of North Weald by placing large sums of money in my hand.
That was a great setup at North Weald, wasn't it? Because you also had those old World War II squadron buildings as well,
For the thing was that the developers never got permission to do this. No. That was 25 years ago, and there's still no houses there.
It's still an airfield, isn't it?
Yeah, and here, still an airfield. Let's talk about 2,600 homes. I mean, if they did do that, could it still be an operational airfield?
No.
No?
No, the first thing they'd want to do is break the runway up. Yeah. They're putting new entrance in, which is very good, which is excellent for the industrial estate and possible housing in the future. And you can't stop progress, you know. You can't sort of stand in front of a tank or something and expect it to stop. So,
unless you're in Chatham Square.
Then you get carted off and never see
it. Oh, that's true. Yeah.
But, I'm an aviation person, but I'm also a realist, you know. And, you know, and, we'd just sort of find somewhere else to move to if they did do it, you know. But right now it's working very well for everybody, and the new road will certainly help, and there's a thriving industrial estate on the other side.
And of course, Top Gear, BBC Top Gear, from which we possibly take our name, Top Landing Gear, was here for a long, long time, wasn't it, using the track? And that's, in another way, put Dunsfold on the map, didn't it?
Yeah, well, Dunsfold basically was a B-25 base built by the Canadians. It's the only airfield actually in the UK during the war actually built by the Canadians. And they had their B-25s built, based here, rather. Mm-hmm. And it after the war, it was bought by a company called Skyways, and they operated DC-4s and 3s and things, and did all the Berlin airlift stuff out of here. And then Hawkers, who were up at Langley on a grass airfield, were developing jets by that time and wanted a proper runway and all the rest, so they moved down here, and Hawkers were here for many years, and then it became BA and BA Systems and all that sort of business, and they developed the vertical takeoff Harrier here. And also, they developed the Hawker, the Red Arrow Zero.
The Hawk,
British Aerospace Hawk was there. So it was quite an interesting place, and I had a very good history. There's a book written about it called Secret Airfield of Surrey.
Yeah, I have that. Yeah, it's super.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the history here is incredible. In fact, Duncan Simpson, who's a great family friend who test flew the Harrier and was the first person to fly the Hawk, actually, he was instrumental in saving the Hurricane. He kind of nicked the Hurricane from here and took it off to the RAF and said, you need to look after this. It was the last Hurricane left. And thanks to him, I think, that sort of instigated, in a way, the Battle of Britain Memorial flight, loosely speaking. But yeah, he took it from a hangar here, Duncan Simpson, flew it up to somewhere and just had it over to the RAF without anyone's permission and said, you need to keep this.
Yeah, that was called the last of the many.
That's right.
And there was another Hurricane here with wooden wings, because the original ones had the wooden wings. And that was in an old hangar on the other side of the airfield. When I was a kid, looking at the numbers in the 60s, you know, I saw this thing and I thought, that's interesting. And it had a maintenance number on it, a sort of 05216M, you know, silver aircraft. And that's now in the Science Museum hanging up in London. That's the Hurricane, here.
Gosh,
that's nothing. Very early one, Mark
One. I remember coming here when it was, they used to have air shows here in the British Aerospace days, when they were still building Harriers in the main hangar. And it was fascinating. You could actually walk around the hangar and see.
Oh, fantastic.
It was the Mark V Harrier at the time, in different stages, from just bare bits to being built all around the hangar. Absolutely fascinating.
Oh, how fantastic, yeah.
Well, they actually built all these things at Kingston.
So Kingston, weren't they?
And they brought them in by lorry.
Yeah.
I remember Hunters coming along. They have about 2 a week, and they were selling Hunters to everybody, and Indian Air Force were, and Swiss Air Force, and all sorts of people.
Yeah.
So it was always an interesting place.
Yeah. Well, it's very much the home of the Hawker Hunter, which brings me on to another story, because of its connection with the Hunter, it was buzzed, Dunsfold, by Alan Pollock on the day that he did that flight, that protest flight over the Houses of Parliament, flying out of Tangmere and back to his base in...
Didn't he go under the bridge?
The guy who flew through Tower Bridge in the Hawker Hunter, Alan Pollock. And I gather, Mike, you have a little story of your own about that day.
Well, I was flying, I think I was an instructor at Fair Oaks, and if someone can find out the actual date, I'll look in my logbook.
April the 8th, 1968.
68.
Yeah, it might have been April 5th, actually, but 1968.
And it's April, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll look that up. Because I was actually flying at the time, and this thing went past, you know, at a distance, but it was very unusual to see a military aircraft in the London zone. It was going from west to east, so I think it must have then turned and then come back in the opposite direction through the bridge. So I thought, wow, well, I wonder what that's doing. It was a camouflage single-seater Hunter, and that was an unusual thing to spot, so we were both in the air at the same time. But in later life, when I flew the police helicopter, we had a bomb scare on the bridge, and the bridge was closed, and we were looking for the bomb. It was an IRA thing, and they were blowing up places.
Yep.
And we went through the bridge, but not underneath the bridge, through the, wasn't it? But that was official.
Yes.
So you are the only eyewitness that we know, apart from Alan Pollock, who we know, to actually see his hunter that day. And in fact, he did. Yeah. He did actually go from west to east through the bridge and out the other side and got out of there. Didn't fly again after that, of course. but you, I think you were quite angry about that, weren't you, at the time? Because you thought it was a little dangerous. He wasn't on the radio. And I think you said that you'd have been in a Cherokee or something, and he passed underneath you at great speed.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm only guessing, but I would think he was doing about 300 knots, and then he wasn't balls out or anything.
No.
But it went past, and it was lower than I was.
Yes. So,
you know, it's one of those things where you don't go into the London zone anyway without permission.
No.
And I think it was a bit reckless,
yes.
You know, whereas the helicopter thing, we were asked to do it, you know, to look for possible devices hanging off the bridge or whatever, you know. But
that must have been a fascinating part of your aviation life, flying helicopters for the police.
Yeah. India 99 was the call sign.
I remember that. So were these squirrels, or was it before the squirrel came in?
We started with the Enstrom, which was the Enstrom helicopter, which was quite a good machine.
That was from the Met, was it?
Yeah.
The Met Police.
We were based at the time, we were based at Battersea, and then we moved to Elstree and then Lippitt's Hill.
Lippitt's Hill. I've flown out of there on a police helicopter at Lippitt's Hill. Yeah. It was here for a while, wasn't it, too? Or was that the air ambulance?
Sorry.
It was the air ambulance.
Air ambulance was here, yeah. And the police were up at Fair Oaks.
Of course.
And then they moved to Odeon for better security because they were getting broken into by people who were smashing the helicopter up and then doing a ramrod job the next morning or whatever. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long would you fly with the police for, Mike?
A couple of years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that interesting? Did that sort of...
It was about 90% boring and 10% very interesting.
So back to the filming. After Airline and Aces High growing and growing and expanding, you got more and more films. And you got involved in the Bond films too, didn't you?
Yeah. The first Bond film we got involved with was a thing called Octopussy. And that involved a Beech 18 aircraft, which was used in the States. We had two of them. One of them, in the film, they're fighting on the top of the plane and one thing or another with, I think, an Indian guy and Bond, you know. And the thing touches down and they jump out and it goes over a cliff. So they had all the cameras set up for this thing to come down and crash and explode. Yeah. And it was on one engine as well. And it went over the cliff and... just picked up speed and flew out a camera shot and then crashed.
Yeah. Really?
So they ended up using a model in the end. But the other one flew across to the UK and landed at Northolt, which is close to Pinewood.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy got out, an American guy, and he said, where are you going to do the film here? And he said, no, it's Pinewood. He said, do you want it delivered to Pinewood? You got a field there? He said, well, there is a bit of a field on the other side. He said, give me $50 or whatever it was, or $500,
really?
And I'll deliver it for you. You know? But I want to look at it first, you know, and have a look. So we took this bloke up, and he looked at it, said, yeah, I can get it in there. So they said, okay. So the bloke flew the thing out of Northolt into the field at Pinewood, went through the hedge at the far end, picked up his money and left it.
The wreck at the end of the field.
So we then got a huge crane, lee-lifting crane, to lift it out of the field and into Pinewood and into the back lot, you know. Then it went on the stage.
Ah, right.
And then afterwards we had the plane up at Duxford and it went into one or two films. It was blue and white, actually, Beech 18.
You didn't fly it out of Pinewood?
No, it came out in a lorry. And it was just 16 feet wide with, you know, the outboard of the engine nacelles. So it just went as a wide load, yeah.
Fantastic.
So that was the first of the Bonds, Octopussy.
Yeah.
And then did you have the taste for it after that? Like, was that your first foray into feature films?
Well, we did something or were involved with Bond films. We got credits on, I think, just about everyone after that. And the last one, we did a big scene here with the container port, which was supposed to be in Jamaica. And there was a seaplane, a Cessna on floats.
Mm-hmm.
It goes down between 300 containers, which we put out on the runway. But that was the only aviation bit that we were vaguely involved with that was all shot here at Dunsfold on the last one. But up until then, we were very active on supplying helicopters and planes and all sorts of things. There's an interesting story which is quite relevant now because we had to do a shot with a very large aircraft, like a C-17 C5 Galaxy, but in fact we used an AN-125, the great big Russian thing, you know, and there was one at Manston, which had been delivered there from Ostend, apparently, a Russian one. So we all went down and had a look at it and talked to the people who bought it and were going to operate it. And they said, yeah, you know, you can use it for the film. And the idea was it had to have cars going in, Ferraris and things going into it, and it's part of the film. And it was fine until we got there one morning to work on it and found that there was a writ mailed to the mast, as it were, from a Ramsgate solicitor saying that on the behalf of Central Capital of Moscow, this aircraft's been seized by the Russians, who said it should never have been sold at auction in Ostend in the first place because it was their plane. So Transair, or not Transair, something Tradewinds, I think it was.
Oh, yes.
So they said, well, there's nothing we can do about it, you know. So I rang them up and they said, we want $2 million or you can't use the plane. Now, they'd built a mock-up, which had cost them about $1 million, and they'd done all the bits and pieces, and I sort of sat there. I wonder if I'll get a job sweeping the stage or something, or maybe cleaning the cars or something, you know, because it had screwed the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I had an idea, and I got on to a friend of mine who was from the Ukraine. Is it the Ukraine? You ever heard of that place?
Something no the anymore now, just Ukraine. Yeah. But I think that's where the Antonovs are from.
Yeah, but they didn't like the Russians. No. Can you imagine?
No. that won't go well, I can tell you. So
when I told them the story and said, look, it's a James Bond film and the aircraft has been seized and could you help us, could you rent us another airplane? I said, when do you need it? I said, in about a week. They said, we'll deliver it on Sunday or something. I can't remember what the deal was. They knew all about this. They knew about it being seized because it was an Antonov. They knew about the Bond film. They knew about the whole story because it had got back to them. And they said, we'll fly it in for you and you can use it. So I thought, well, it's unbelievable. And it arrived with the registration number UR-007.
Oh, wow.
Because they could do whatever they liked. They built it. Yeah. So. And I got on board this thing and there were holes in the flight deck, you know, where things were missing. I said, well, what goes in there? It's the flight director. And I said, well, yeah, we've got one on the other side, so don't worry about it. And it was like a thing of the Virgin Mary sort of swinging in its place, you know, on a string. And they'd rushed this bloody thing off the production line and we got it there. And it's, you know, and we managed to pull the other one out from where it was parked and put this one there. And they said, yeah, you can have that. So it was unbelievable, you know. That if you see the film, you'll see it. And then when some of the art department said, we can't use that. I said, why not? They said, because it's a different colour to the model. I said, I got an idea.
Repaint the model. Yeah, there you go. Clever. Very clever.
Which Bond was this? Which film was this? Do you remember?
That was the one, I think, with Halle Berry.
Oh, yes.
They all sort of, they're all like...
Oh, Roy, you're the expert, which one was it?
It's the Pierce Brosnan one, it's...
Where they're running to try and get into the plane, they jump up on the undercarriage. Yeah. And I was actually taxiing the plane.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they said, what speed can they run at? And someone said 12 miles an hour, which you can't, you know, you can't sustain that for very long. Bond jumped up and the poor old Halle Berry went back to her trailer and she was bloody exhausted.
You don't see that in the film, do you?
And it was just giving up. Hands on the hips.
I'll just take it.
You imagine chasing one of those things down a runway at night.
Yeah.
And we switched the inboard engines off and just taxied on the outboards. But the noise, for a start, you know, and the big wheels going round, and they had to sort of get up onto the wheels and get into the, which we used to stunt people for. Yeah. But she had to actually get to the thing with him and, you know, and look as though they were, you know, going to go up. And then they switched to the back of the stunt people who actually went up the wheels. And you don't know what speed you're doing in those things because the airspeed indicator is dependent on the wind. So you don't know what your actual...
Yeah,
they just said, sort of slow down a bit, you know. And I didn't want to be. And it had, part of the deal was they said, you're going to have to accommodate the crew and pay the crew, yeah. So I said, oh, fine, no problem. We had 23 crew on it. They had sort of four load masters and six bloody flight engineers. And
that was just keeping Swinging Mary oiled.
And they sat in this thing like a Nimrod, you know, with screens and things, and said, oh, he's the navigator, and he's the second navigator, and he's the radio operator, and he's the assistant radio operator, and he's the co-pilot, he's the pilot, he's the third officer, he's the... And it was just full of people, you know, and they were lovely people, and we had a great time. We were down at Manston for about 3 nights shooting this thing. Yeah.
Did they just want to be in the Bond film? Is that why there were so many people there?
Yeah, well, I didn't realise that the Ukrainians didn't like the Russians until recently.
I think it's The World Is Not Enough. I think that's...
Is it?
I think so.
Yeah, it might be.
Yeah.
Is that Timothy Dalton? No, I'm not going to try and outdo you on this. Yeah. No, you
might If someone said to me, name the last 8 Bond films or whatever, even having worked on them, I can't... Because it's always die, another do, another live, another... I can remember Spectre and Goldfinger, then, of course, there was GoldenEye. They all seem to have...
Yeah. They're not very imaginative on their naming, are they?
But the big one for Dunsfold was... well, this was returned to Miami, wasn't it? Airport with the jumbo...
Oh, the Cirrus 200 jumbo.
It was Casino Royale.
The engines obviously modified and...
I bought that for Bond, actually. Yeah.
That's literally the most rock and roll thing I've ever heard. Someone just bought a 747 for Bond. That's just the way you roll.
Well, Barbara Broccoli said, you know, we need some big plane, you know, and we need to do it at Dunsfold. And it's supposed to be an experimental plane. There's some pictures of it up there on the wall in the various skies that it was supposed to be. It wasn't supposed to be a 747 or an Airbus. It was supposed to be a sort of... whatever it was, a sky leader or something, a sky plane or something. And it was being built in Miami, and it was the prototype, and they were going to blow it up and get the shares of the company would have collapsed or something. It was all financially motivated. It wasn't like a terrorist thing.
Yeah.
Mike, I'm looking out of the window of your control tower office at that very aircraft now, and more recent 747 and a VC-10. It's a bit of a treat. And I can just see the modified... Whose idea was it to put the two... Nacelles, is that the correct terminology? Together. And was it done here, or...?
It's like B-52.
It must have been done here, otherwise it wouldn't have got here, would it?
Yeah, we flew it in on the regular engines, and we sold the engines. And they made those... Peter Lamotte, who was production designer on most of the Bonds, who died a few years ago, won an Oscar on Titanic, fantastic guy. Wow. He actually designed those. And they went round with electric motors. And then the fuel tanks on the wings, on the other pods... Mm-hmm. Because most of the stuff was shot below the wings, you know, all the fight scenes and stuff. So everything on the close-ups had to be for real. On the CGI, you could do distant stuff, but you can't have people fighting amongst CGI, you know. So, they were done at... They were actually built at Pinewood and fitted here. And then after the film, we kept them,
And did they... I mean, it has... Instead of the hump, it's a bit like an A380 in that the upper deck goes all the way back to the tail. Was that actually done here?
That was CGI.
That was CGI, was it?
Yeah. Because it was above the wing.
Yeah.
I'd never noticed that until I'm looking out of the window now. I noticed that that's not there.
No, that's right. Yeah.
How extraordinary.
Yeah.
See, when I drove past Dunsfold, the jumbos are always moving. I never see... Firstly, I've never seen them actually move. I just notice they're in different parts. Who gets to do that? Why do you do it? And how often do you do it? And
they do it themselves at night.
Very disobedient. Yeah.
Job. Come on, Roy. This is the magic of film television.
We're breeding them.
Oh, then you were.
Like, so sometimes when you drive, I come back quite late at night, frequently to come home, driving past Dunsfold, and there'll be... The first time I ever drove back when I moved to the country, there was obviously filming something, but I had no idea they were doing filming in... There was even a film set here. Yeah. And I didn't know what was happening. I thought like we were being invaded or something. Because the light that it gives off when they've got when they're filming here...
Yeah, but they aren't that.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But who does actually move the jumbos? Do you get to do it?
Or? Well, we've got tractor tugs and... there's a guy here that actually is ex-British Airways, he moves them around for us. So if we like, for instance, that one is going out on the runway next week for 3 or 4 days.
This is the British Airways Chatham Dockyard one, is it?
That's going into a big film, I think, on starts shooting on Tuesday of next week, so we're moving on Monday.
Okay.
But we have to move the VC-10 out the way, so we put that somewhere else.
Now, the VC-10... do tell us about that, because that isn't yours, is it?
No,
it belonged, I think, past parcel to Brooklands, but I think, is it now owned by a leasing company who are going to turn it into a tanker to go and operate in the States, or was that all gone by the way?
The only bit I really know is that it is the last one ever built at Brooklands, and that the Brooklands runway was sort of dug up, and they couldn't land the thing there, so this was about the closest place.
Oh.
So they bought it in here, and they used to do engine runs and things on it.
Yes.
And then they decided to sell it, and they sold it, I think, to a company that was looking at turning them, well, they're already tankers, but buying several of them and use them for a United States Air Force contract somewhere in America.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, I think they use converted 707s. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened and why it didn't go or whatever, but it's still here. And
do you have use of it for the filming, or is it...
If a film comes up, like The Crown or something, they CGI'd into BOAC colours, you know.
Ah.
Yeah.
I thought they'd use the one at Duxford for that. But they've come here and done that, have they?
Yeah.
Gosh.
It's your favourite aircraft of all time, isn't it?
I think it is, because my prep school was at the end of the runway at Wisley, so I just saw VC-10s and BAC-111s throughout my entire early childhood. I then came to Cranley and just watched Harriers all day long. Didn't do very well in A-levels. But I did watch a lot of aeroplanes during my school years. Yeah, so the VC-10 has a very special place in my heart, I have to say.
Yeah, it was the idea was right of having an aircraft that could operate in Africa on runways which were too short for 707s or DC-8s and what have you. But the thinking was wrong, because all they did was just lengthen the runways.
That's what was happening to British aviation a lot of the time, wasn't it? They were... very specific demands from BOAC as to what they wanted from Vickers, as it was then. They built this brilliant aircraft, the VC-10, but as you rightly say, by the time it was up in the market, the runways had been lengthened, and actually the 707 was more economical, and the VC-10 got slightly elbowed out. Similar thing, I think, happened to the Trident. BEA making very specific demands of what they wanted. Then once it was delivered,
My father just said that the British aviation airline industry would say, what do you want?
Yeah.
Whereas the Americans would say, this is what we do. And this is what you get wins at the end of the day, because they're not tailoring everything specifically. You change your operation to our airliner.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, probably we could talk about the downturn in the British aviation industry.
We might do that.
Yes.
I've still got plans for that show. But Mike, you never flew a VC-10, did you?
No. I flew in VC-10s quite a lot to Africa when we were working in Africa.
Oh, wow.
With East African airlines, and used to go up on the flight deck and what have you. But in those days, you could, before the terrorist doors and things were fitted, you could ask to go on the cockpit, show them your pilot's license, and have a chat.
Nice.
But I did fly on the Russian VC-10 scheme.
Oh, the Aleutian IL-62.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Mm. Ugly.
Yes,
they tried to copy the VC-10 and failed.
They say that imitation is the most sincere form of flattery.
They do, indeed. So, Mike, back to the Bonds, because this is lovely. We love talking about the Bond stuff, not least Roy. What was the next thing after the extraordinary 747 with the engine nestles?
Well, we did lots of film. The main film we got going on was the airline film with the Ruskin, as you say. And they were going to do another series. They were going to pick up on the Coronation Day, actually, 1953, and go from there. And we would have got sort of various things. Because we finished on the Berlin airlift, I think.
Yeah.
And then, so I went out and bought a Constellation for them for the show, which is a picture of it here going through up there. Look, see it coming through with the traffic.
Yeah.
And it was abandoned in Dublin. And we bought it and bought it back. And then when the show was cancelled, we sold it. We didn't sell it, actually. We donated it to the Science Museum at Rorton, painted it in TWA colours, and did a deal with TWA that we could get tickets, seats available, and we would do a big publicity thing with it. And it's still there today.
It's still
painted in. So we saved the thing from being broken up.
Yeah.
I think it's the only Constellation in the UK.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. I think Breitling have one, don't they, over in on the continent, which flies in occasionally for air shows.
Yeah.
Stunning aeroplane.
That was a super Constellation.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So in terms of the other aviation films, so you own some aircraft, but then you acquire others for films, do you? Is that how,
yeah,
how
it yeah, works? Somebody comes along and wants something if we don't have it. Like we're doing, one of the films we're doing at the moment involves an AN-26, mm-hmm. which, again, is coming from the Ukraine. Yeah? Mm. And they'll wonder why there's so many Ukrainian flags in England and not so many in Ukraine. Isn't it?
Yes. It's been a bigger supporter than they are.
Yeah.
Mike, Robert, what's the aircraft you've most enjoyed owning, if that's a question you can even answer?
I think it's got to be the DC-3, really, because the DC-3 has been the thing that's started, you know, I started with and ended up with and still have. And we've done loads and loads and loads of films. Every time you see a film on television, you know, an old war film or whatever, the chances are it's that plane, you know. We did a lot of stuff with other interesting planes, like de Havilland Herons, which are four-engine things, which Queen's Flight used to have, you yes. know. Mm-hmm. And we set up an airline down in St. Lucia, St. Lucia Railways, mm-hmm. which was turned out to be a CIA operation.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and it was mainly flying stuff into Angola. Yeah.
Wow. Oh, really? Right.
Not with the Herons.
No.
I bought a couple of 707s from British Airways or whatever they were called in those days. Mm. British, I think.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
With the Conway engines, you know, they burnt about 8 tonnes an hour of fuel. You know. And then they went down to Panama and had freight doors put in, and they were used by the company. For
so that's sort of Air America type setup. Yeah.
So is it fair to say, Mike, you've done a bit of stuff, a bit of off-book stuff in your time? That you can't tell us about.
But do feel free.
But might like to. No one's going to listen.
Yeah, yeah. Probably not on the mic now.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'll admit to working for the British government.
Yeah. Is that as far as it goes?
Yeah.
Okay. Even wanting more, Mike, that's always right.
It was XL Airways, but it was called Peach Air before that. And it was when they... There had been a hijacking of a 727 at Stansted, and Peach Air, I think it was at the time, or the forerunners of XL, were the only UK operator of the 727 at the time, and so they had to fly one at night into Stansted, into a hangar, for the Hereford chaps to go and practice on, so they knew everything about a 727.
Yes.
And then they could have a go on the real thing. So all sorts of stuff does go on, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we try and help if we can. You know. Yeah. I've never been a spy or anything like that. I'm just a pilot.
Yeah. What's your proudest achievement within your sort of world of aviation?
I think the most exciting thing in my life was when I found a half-eaten Hershey bar in a garbage bin. But that was another story.
You can always do a part two.
No, I mean, I've had a fair share of... exciting moments, you know, crashed in the sea on the way back from Australia and had a multiple bird strike.
Yeah. What were you flying?
We were flying three X Flying Doctor Service Beagle 206 S's, which were the Mark IIs, and they just replaced them with the Nomad.
Yeah.
And we were out of Broken Hill, yeah. Mm. And unfortunately, one of the we took off in very bad weather in December 1986, I think it was. I'm a member of the Goldfish Club, actually.
Ah.
Yeah. And hit birds on takeoff, got a multiple bird strike. Seagulls. They found about 30 on the runway. Wrecked the airplane completely. I was heading towards Albania trying to get some height, but the cloud base was fairly low, and I thought I'd better stay VFR, and it's shaking and rattling, and the windscreens had cracked and crushed as well. And the birds were sort of going in one side and coming out through the plane was written off in the air. Mm-hmm. I started a slow turn to the left, and then it left engine quit, and it rolled over on its back and went in. There's a picture of it up there.
Oh,
painting.
Went in quite. You didn't sort of do a nice gentle approach. You went in.
No, it's like hitting concrete. Actually. Yeah. Luckily, it had military harness on it. You know, and I had big shoulder straps on. I had bruises for about 3 months on the shoulders.
Christ.
Yeah.
And you had a dinghy to jump into, did you?
had a dinghy, had Sabis, had radio, had everything, couldn't get to anything. Couldn't even get a life jacket. Really? But it was nice and cold at being December. Had 10 minutes to live, basically.
Yeah. Sure. This is in the Med?
This was off of between Albania and Corfu.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And if we'd have made it to Albania, King Zog or somebody was running it at the time.
Yeah, it was King Zog.
Yeah. And they had sort of 18-year-old kids with 303s, and they just shot anyone that came on the beach. Fishermen, anyone, if the fishing boat broke down. Wow. They just shot you. So I thought, no, go that way, get shot. If I stay here, I'll drown. Go that way. So
that's a nice doner kebab.
Someone picked you up, did they?
Yeah, the second plane, I was second. The first plane had gone, the second aircraft I was in, and the third aircraft, was just two crew, just pilot and co-pilot. We'd come all the way from Australia, and we were heading for Gatwick, actually. And then we were going to go to Biggin Hill, and it was going to be eventually ferried to the States, because it didn't have enough range to get the other way around through Hawaii and all that. And you couldn't. We had long range, 55-gallon drums on the stretcher things inside. But it was fun. I had a fractured skull, broke all my ribs, got pneumonia.
Apart from that, was all right.
I know we're having one of those days. Nothing's going right.
So that's really not going right in the big way, isn't it?
Yeah.
So like the Dunsfold these,
and a few other things.
Yeah, Dunsfold these days is dominated by these three jumbos, and of course the two more recent ones, the 747-400s, which belong to British Airways, which you brought in a couple of years back. Just tell us the story of how you acquired those and why, and what the plan is for them. That's a lot to cover.
Yeah, the plan is that we were going to retire the old 200. It was getting a bit long in the tooth, but then we found that everybody on the filming all wanted like films in the 80s or The Crown or whatever, or Air Force One, and of course that was the one, so that gets more utilization than the others. But the others, strangely enough, someone rang up, a guy from Mr. Walsh's office, I think he was the chairman of British Airways, very nice Irish chap actually, he used to be chairman of Aer Lingus as well, I believe. And it was a sort of would you be wanting a 747, you know?
At all.
They just spent £7 million on doing all the new interior on it and all the
club suites and everything.
The in-flight entertainment system and everything and all the rest. And they didn't want to see them broken up. In fact, they were being charged a lot of money to break them up, you know. So it made sense to everybody. So I said, okay, well, you know, you can see we've been looking after one for 15 years, so we're not a bunch of guys that are, you know, going to mess about or whatever. So anyway, they landed and everyone thought the thing had crashed, and people were saying, oh, we heard it land but never take off again. We only used half the runway. I wasn't in the plane, I was in the tower actually doing the air traffic control bit. And it was very successful, and then the engines went and all the rest, and we did the bond and so on. So we move on 15 years to the new ones. And we got this call, would we like a replacement for it? And we'll deliver it, what have you. So we did it. And then about a month later, we got another call saying that they'd been let down by the people at the airport that was St. Morgan's, Newquay Airport.
Yeah.
And that the council were closing down the aviation side, and it was going to have a tourist attraction down there and build a hangar for it, or put it in a hangar or whatever. That all got cancelled. And they'd painted it up in the Landor scheme, which is rather nice. I like that.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And it looked lovely. Now we're doing a special offer.
This is Willy Wolf.
Yeah, buy one and get one for free. Do you want another one? You know, I'm going, what else you got? You know. So I took another one. So we ended up with the two.
But obviously that period around COVID and lockdown is what kind of contributed to the end of the 747. Yeah.
That's why it was the COVID thing that retired the DC-3, and it was the COVID thing that set us off with the 747s. Those would have still been in service for another 4 to 5 years, I think. They were actually talking about keeping them in service, especially with all the money they'd spent on it.
So did British Airways pay you to take care of their jumbos, or did you pay them?
No, we paid them.
Are we allowed to ask how much?
No.
I've heard rumours from... It started £1 and goes up to about £2 million. So you, somewhere in that, is that about right?
Sorry?
Somewhere between £1 and £2 million you paid for them?
Yeah, somewhere between that.
I knew we'd narrow it down.
You're right on the money, you know. It's like people say, you say to somebody, if they want to sell a car or something, how much do you take for it? Oh, I don't know. You take £1. No, would you take £1 million? Yes, well, then you do.
I see. Right. Okay, we're not going to get very far on that one. But they are here, and they just look fantastic. In fact, we witnessed the arrival of both of them, actually. Mm. And it was just... I think many people were so pleased to see you rescue the Landor, just because it's a beautiful colour scheme.
Yeah.
James worries me by telling me today that it looks like the one that's in BOAC colours is being threatened with...
Yeah, I think it's a St. Athan.
Yeah.
And they're talking about scrapping it.
Have you got any space here, Mike? Could you take another?
Well, the only reason we could take them because we could fly them in.
Quite.
And I think the thing, they spend a few months off the... You know, flying thing, it would cost millions to get them going.
To get it back up again. Yeah.
But we'll get you when my people come back, we'll get you onto the aeroplane. You can have a look round. I've got the problem with arthritis in my blimmin' knees at the moment, so I won't come up the steps with you. But,
and do you have a plan? I mean, particularly the Landor one, it's quite sort of culturally significant, some people might say. Do you have plans to keep it as it is, or is it any sort of heritage?
Well, the thing is, I mean, even if they dug the runway up here, we don't need to fly them. We don't need the runway, so we can probably carry on with the filming and what have you. So we're just seeing where we go. But, I mean, there's so many airfields like Robin Hood Airfield and the place that we just spoke about in Newquay and all these all being closed down, you know. They're closing everything to build houses.
The Vulcan, Vulcan's in a bit of strife, isn't it? Because they don't know what to do with it now.
Yeah.
They can't... It's very unlikely they'll ever be able to fly it out of... Robin Hood, and if it does go, they'd have to go on a lorry in bits, or they'd have to try and arrange to keep it there with the owners of the airfield. But
they were talking about Scampton, and the council done a really good deal apparently with a group of people, Scampton Holdings, which were going to have a museum there. That's and the heritage and everything else. And we thought about maybe moving the DC-3 up there. If the other place closed, and what have you. And then I heard, we're going to turn it into
an immigration centre.
So what can we look forward to production-wise that will be coming out of Dunsfold, Mike, in the near future?
Production-wise?
Yeah, that's being shot here.
And then you can tell us about, or is it all... Do you have to keep everything under wraps until it comes out?
We have to sign NDAs, so we're not allowed to talk about stuff that's actually in progress at the moment. We can talk about things that have been, once they've been released, then we can talk about them. So, people say, what's the new Bond going to be called and who's going to be Bond and when's it? I mean, I don't know.
Might you have been approached about the next Bond?
The next one.
You don't know.
I know nothing.
are film and TV media types easy to work with, or do they understand aviation, or is that part of your job to explain to them what you can and can't do?
Well, our main consideration is health and safety. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a boring combination of words, health and safety, but. You've got to be so careful these days that you don't do something like that car blowing up. It could have landed on top of somebody or whatever. It's uncontrolled, and we try and control things. So we have aviation coordinators and everything is discussed before we do anything. And if the military are here doing things, we know ahead of time if there's going to be explosions or gunfire or whatever, and we, touch wood, we've... never had a major incident in 40 years of filming, but a lot of other people have, and planes and helicopters have crashed and goodness knows what, we try to take as much care as possible to make sure that everything is safe, and if we don't like something, we won't do it. We've had people say, we want you to fly up over the top of the hangar in the helicopter, and say, no, we're not doing that. If the engine stops, we'll crash into the hangar. Oh, the engine's not going to stop. No, I'm sorry, we're not doing it. And unless you put your foot down and, you give them the rope, they'll eventually hang themselves with it,
And a particular bugbear of mine, and I think Rob's as well, is inaccuracy. Now, obviously, budget constraints mean certain things can't be done. But when you see something that's so obviously wrong in a film or in a, even in the news, when they say, well, today a British Airways aircraft, and they'll show a jumbo this year, you say, well, you could at least get the right type. Do you have an issue, or you just say, well, whatever the budget, you work to the budget?
Well, that's the continuity people, you know. In the old days, if you watch the old days, like Sir Trillions or whatever, you know, they're all going off abroad somewhere, so they all go rushing up to Heathrow and get on an Avro York, and then you see a Stratacruiser in flight, yeah, exactly. And then a Viscount lands in New York or something. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't get it more wrong.
That's but, right.
Yeah, but then they do make films that are deliberate, like Airplane,
yeah,
things,
exactly.
Which
well,
you die laughing because, yeah, you know, you see a jet 707 and it's got the noise of a Lancaster.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. Very that
yeah. But do you advise like that, Mike?
Yeah,
make sure things
yeah,
like that do
I,
not happen.
I do a lot of stuff with Hollywood, actually, on the phone with the script department. They'll come on and say, we need to have a rescue scene or a scene where somebody gets, you know, out of this or into that, mm-hmm. or how would this work, and what about pressurisation, and how high would this go, and how fast would that go, and you know, and I get paid actually as a script coordinator, yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, script advisor basically.
Yeah.
Just on aviation stuff, yeah.
Do you want another pedant on the books? Because Rob is one. Knows his stuff. Hates inaccuracies, knows his aircraft. There you go.
Thanks, bro. Very kind of you.
The trick is to actually, if somebody asks for something you haven't got, is to try and offer something very similar that you can get if they want a C-130, which are virtually impossible to get.
Yeah.
Because they're all rushing around doing stuff. You get an AN-12, which looks like a C-130, which is what we did for World War Z, the zombie film, yeah. Which we did here. And if you look closely, you'll see that it changes from a C-130 into a AN-12.
Does it?
And the flight deck and all sorts of things.
I think there are about to be an awful lot of C-130s becoming available in this country. Aren't the RAF about to?
I think they're all sold.
Oh, they've all been...
Oh, yeah, they've been gone, yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, they came out in 1953, and you still can't get one.
No,
we did a film called Entebbe in Malta, which was about Idi Amin. And we needed a C-130 because the Israelis actually bought three of them in with all their, you know, with the car inside and all this stuff.
The ambassadorial car, didn't they, yes.
And we actually managed to get one in South Africa. You know, that was as near as Malta we could get, actually.
Do you think that computer graphics are going to take some of your job away, CGI, or is it make it even more sort of a requirement to have an actual aircraft to
well,
fit in?
Yeah, it's one of those things. So when CGI first came out, everyone thought, well, it's going to, that's the end of flying sequences and stuff. And it was very expensive.
Mm.
Now it's a lot cheaper and a lot better. I mean, if you watch the film Pearl Harbor, it's unbelievable. You're on a bomb following it down, and it goes down the funnel of a ship or something, you know, and it's like you're riding it, you know. It just doesn't work, you know. But if you do it these days, and the great thing about it is that if the thing isn't moving, it's reasonably inexpensive as such to do it.
Yeah.
So we still use the planes.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned before, the VC-10 would go into BOAC colours.
Mm-hmm.
Or it'll go into some other colour scheme without actually doing anything to it. We've just done the door on one of the planes, which I think you'll see as Air Force One for one of these seven films mm-hmm. you're talking about. I don't know which one it is. And we can do the close-up stuff where there's movement, but if you just see a plane sitting on the ramp, we can change it. Or we don't do CGI, but the CGI people can change that into anything, basically.
Right.
And the other thing is they're able to replicate it. So in the Entebbe film, you'll see three C-130s. There's only one. But the others, the propellers are running and everything, and you can't tell the difference, you know. So you normally need one hero aircraft, if you like, you know, which you can do stuff on and around and in and flight decks and things, and then you can CGI the others. And the background aircraft can all be CGI'd. And flying aircraft can be CGI'd. I mean... On the old films, they were on strings, you know, and they were all at different angles going along, you know, sort of thing. Yeah.
I do remember
it had
seeing
a charm,
one,
though.
There was one film that came out probably 5 years ago. I can't remember. It was a Second World War film, but it looked quite good. I think it was about Hurricanes.
303 Squadron.
303. But they were sort of doing 90 degree turns in the sky, and there was no bank. You know,
it was like watching Thunderbirds.
Whoever had done the CGI had no idea how airplanes fly, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And it was. Pretty poor.
Well, I don't think we've got any bad films as such that I wouldn't watch. I mean, there are one or two films that, you know, that were made back in the 50s, and they did, like, Dam Busters and things, which they did extremely well, you know, considering they were limited on what they had to work with. Mm-hmm. And those films are very watchable, you know, very watchable. And because they're in black and white, they're even more watchable, you know.
Yeah.
But then you watch Battle of Britain, which you go to sleep watching that. Because you can't tell which planes are which.
Yeah,
they had hurricanes painted up with German markings on and things, and the music was all wrong because the bloke that wrote the music got fired.
Yes, that's right, and they used Ron Goodwin. Not as bad as a film I recently saw where they had Spitfires painted as Messerschmitts, and Messerschmitts or Bouchons painted as Spitfires. Now, what the hell is going on there? It was unbelievably appalling.
Which one was that?
I can't remember. I did tweet it on
it's Mike's most recent.
It was an absolute shocker. Oh, Mike, listen, thank you so much for giving us your time this morning, and I think on behalf of many aviation fanatics, thank you for preserving these wonderful 747s that we have here and the other aircraft, and that, you know, the heritage that you're looking after in aviation.
We enjoy it. As I say, I think it is a hobby that got out of control, which is where we started, really. And I've enjoyed it very much. And I'm sort of semi-retired now, so I can stay in bed until 5 o'clock in the morning.
Take it easy. Yeah.
Do you ever have any open days or chance for the public to come and see your aircraft?
Not as such. We used to, because we had the wings and wheels and we did tours through the planes and things. But with all this goings on, with the possible development and various things happening, and because the runway was in doubt as to whether it would be here now, you know, and I think the wings and wheels was discontinued when COVID came in, and I think that knocked the air shows on the head.
Mm-hmm.
We don't actually have open days as such.
Yeah.
You have to have a podcast to get onto the site.
We'll get you guys on the plane today.
Lovely, we'd love that. We'd love that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mike.
So much.
Fantastic.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Mike.
My pleasure. Yeah.
And true to his word, Mike did get us onto his 747s, and you can hear that little treat in our next episode. And if you'd like to listen to any or all of our podcasts so far, you'll find them on our website, toplandinggear.com, or wherever you normally get your podcasts. And please do subscribe, it's completely free. And let us know anything or anyone you'd like us to feature, and we'll try and make it happen. We'll be back soon with James's Reno Air Races special. And remember, you can get in touch with us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Top Landing Gear. And do email us with your questions for our expert James at info@toplandinggear.com. That's info@toplandinggear.com, 2 G's. And do check out the socials for news of future episodes, because we've no idea when or what they'll be. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Bye for now.